You are listening to WXOJ LP
in Northampton, Massachusetts.
Tonight I want to take a few minutes to discuss a grave threat to peace.
To protect the haves from the have-nots.
The threat comes from America's determination to lead the world, its history of aggression, and its drive toward an arsenal of terror.
To maintain the security of those who accumulate wealth from the labor of others.
El imperialismo norteamericano.
To protect wealth from the poverty that wealth creates.
Freedom is the universal gift of Almighty God.
The God-given promise that all are equal, all are free.
How do you think he'll react to you when you learn what a real revolution is?
I do not believe that a few people should control the wealth of any land, that it should be a collective ownership.
Fellow citizens, your enemy is ruling your country, and war is what they got.
Today, this is as good as it's going to get in Iraq.
Human rights are subordinated to the overwhelming, overriding need of profit.
We believe that as a people living in the United States, it is our responsibility to resist the injustices done by our government in our name.
We must be prepared to match actions with words by seeking out every creative method of protest possible.
Gotta take the power back!
Welcome to this week's edition of Seeing Red Radio, the radio show with a revolutionary socialist perspective. I'm your host, Anthony Udell. Welcome to the program. On this week's edition of Seeing Red Radio, an Afghan police chief claims the two farmers were killed. Of course, U.S. NATO-led forces claim it was two militants. Meanwhile, in Israel, while Labor joins Likud to form a coalition government, rumors of atrocities in Gaza ferment. We'll also look at international mining firms cheating African countries, and who's the latest spokesman for the anti-EFCA forces? Why, Joe the Plumber. That's all on this week's edition of Seeing Red Radio. Check out the website at seeingredradio.org. Please stay tuned.
Going to make the world safe for democracy, aren't you?
What is democracy?
Well, I give you the kind of government. It's got something to do with young men killing each other, I believe.
What has been created by this half century of massive corporate propaganda is what's called anti-politics.
Our political leaders like to pretend that there are no classes in this country, that all of us have the same interest, Exxon and me, George Bush and you. But we've always had class struggle.
The development of modern industry cuts from under its feet the very foundation on which the bourgeoisie produces and appropriates products. What the bourgeoisie, therefore, produces above all are its own grave diggers. Its fall and the victory of the proletariat are equally inevitable.
Things are really bad, and everybody who's out here knows that.
It's really starting to hit, like, the mainstream, so...
We're going to have to adapt our program as conditions change. We will announce the details of this plan in the next few weeks. We believe this program should ultimately provide up to $1 trillion in financing capacity.
The numbers are staggering. The economic stimulus bill that President Barack Obama will sign into law Tuesday is worth $787 billion. That's enough money to buy nearly 2,500 Airbus 380s, the world's largest passenger jets. But how does all that cash trickle down to everyday Americans?
But I don't see it helping me, and all these people getting deals and stuff, it's not helping me.
How can you justify paying bonuses to managers that were running their company into the ground?
When you took taxpayers' money, you moved into a fishbowl.
What part of your job would you not do? Would you, like, leave early on Wednesday, or... Would you take longer lunches?
You come to us today on your bicycles after buying Girl Scout cookies and helping out Mother Teresa.
I've told my board of directors that my salary should be $1 per year.
I will pay my company to allow me to work there. And while there, I will carry around a 50-pound bag of sand. To remind me of my own incompetence, employees will be encouraged, nay, required, to spit or urinate upon me. And I will no longer wear my prized World's Best Boss t-shirt. I will no longer do
it! With a bad situation getting worse in Afghanistan, President Barack Obama has made his first troop decision signing off on sending about 17,000 Marines and soldiers there in the coming months, a down payment on the thousands more the top American commander in Afghanistan has long requested. The president calls it a solemn decision, but one necessary to stabilize a deteriorating security situation. Taking a jab at his predecessor, says Afghanistan has not received the resources it needs. But as for how long the extra troops will stay?
I do not have yet a timetable for how long that's going to take. What I know is I'm not going to allow Al-Qaeda or Bin Laden to operate with impunity planning attacks on the U.S. home.
The new units getting their orders are an Army Striker Brigade from Washington's Fort Lewis and a Marine Expeditionary Brigade from Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. But analysts say just sending more troops won't do the job.
The United States and other NATO countries will not be around forever. This has to be an Afghan solution is the only long-term way for the insurgency to be quelled.
The RAND Corporation's Seth Jones has gone to Afghanistan more than a dozen times and says the focus must be on training Afghan forces, which is what many of the new U.S. troops will be doing. But until they're ready, the results won't be pleasant as more American troops pour in.
The violence levels will almost definitely increase, and probably pretty significantly over the course of 2009. The Taliban has penetrated in a number of areas of the country.
While there are more troop decisions to come, there are also several reviews underway of U.S. strategy in Afghanistan, with the Obama administration signaling it may roll back some U.S. goals there, with the focus now of eliminating terror safe havens, instead of the Bush administration's bigger goal of bolstering the Afghan democracy. Sagar Meghani, the Associated Press, the Pentagon.
NATO-led troops shot dead two Afghan farmers who were watering their land in East Afghanistan, an Afghani police chief said. Afghan President Hamid Karzai has said civilian casualties are the biggest cause of tension between him and his Western backers, who have about 70,000 troops in Afghanistan fighting a Taliban-led insurgency. The two Afghans were killed late on Tuesday just outside Khost City and at the end of the capital, Kabul. Provincial Police Chief Abdul Qayyum Baghazoi said, adding they were innocent civilians, farmers, tending their own land. A spokesman for NATO-led forces said the alliance was investigating an incident in Khost, but would not give any further details or information. The incident follows a dispute between U.S. military and the Afghan government over the deaths of five Afghans killed in the northern Kunduz province during a U.S. raid last week. Officials said the dead were not militants, but employees of a district mayor. But U.S. military said detailed intelligence had led them to a compound where they responded to hostile fire. More than 2,100 civilians were killed in Afghanistan last year, 40% more than in 2007. The United Nations said around a quarter were killed by international forces, it also said. Separately in Khost, a roadside bomb killed eight civilians aboard a minibus and wounded eight others, NATO-led forces said. You're listening to Seeing Red. We'll be right back.
What's that I hear now ringing in my ears? I've heard that sound before. What's that I hear now ringing in my ears? I hear it more and more. It's the sound of freedom calling, ringing up to the skies. It's the sound of the old ways of falling. You can hear it if you try. You can hear it if you try. Oh, what's that I see now shining in my eyes? I've seen that light before. Hey, what's that I see now shining in my eyes? I see it more and more. It's the light of freedom calling, shining up to the sky. It's the light of the old ways of falling. You can see it if you try. You can see it if you try. Hey, what's that I feel now beating in my heart? I've felt that beat before. Hey, what's that I feel now beating in my heart? I feel it more and more. It's the rumble of freedom calling, climbing up to the skies. It's the rumble of the old ways of falling. You can feel it if you try. You can feel it if you try.
Phil Oakes right here on Seeing Red Radio. The decision of the Labour Party to join the rightist coalition led by Benjamin Netanyahu allows Likud to form a government. If all of Labour's Knesset members maintain their support for the move, Netanyahu will have 66 to 67 seats in the 120-member parliament and will be sworn in as Prime Minister Tuesday. The Labour Party will sit in the Knesset as part of the most right-wing government in Israel's history. It has joined the government despite Likud being explicitly opposed to a two-state solution and the stated goal of establishing a Palestinian state. The nominal political difference separating Labour from the overtly right-wing parties. Even Kadima, the party established by Ariel Sharon, refused to join the coalition unless Netanyahu at least formally endorsed a two-state policy. Likud's other major coalition partner is the far-right Israel Beitenu of Avigdor Lieberman, who is in favor of the ethnic cleansing of Israeli Arabs. Lieberman has been appointed as Netanyahu's foreign minister. Likud won one seat less than the Kadima party of outgoing foreign minister Tzipi Livni, but was asked to form a government by President Shimon Peres because the rightist parties enjoyed an overall majority. But Netanyahu was urged by the Obama administration in the United States and by the European Union to strive to include either Kadima or Labour so his government could be depicted as being less extreme than it really was. Labour will do more than provide a fig leaf for the continued support by the major powers and the complicity of Washington's Arab allies in Israel's offensive against the Palestinians. Party leader Ehud Barak will personally spearhead attacks on the Palestinians and any hostile moves that are made against Iran, retaining the post of defense minister he occupied in the outgoing coalition government with Kadima. Barak's horse trading with Netanyahu also secured Labour four cabinet portfolios, in addition to defense, industry, trade and labor, agriculture, and welfare and social services, and one position as minister without portfolio. As well as heading the Israeli military, Labour will play a key role in imposing austerity measures on the working class. The chairman of the Histadrut Trade Union Federation, Ofer Eini, secured an agreement to take part in all socioeconomic discussions and tripartite roundtable arrangements with the government and the employers. Barak's decision won the support of a narrow majority of Labour's Central Committee in Tuesday's party convention, where 680 delegates voted to join, while just 507 voted against. He was opposed by a group of Labour MKs headed by Amir Peretz and Shelly Yakimovich, but afterwards Yakimovich said that she respected the outcome. Cabinet Minister Yuli Tamir, one of the founders of Peace Now, has merely stated that she had not yet decided if she will vote with the government. Labour's joining the coalition was entirely predictable. Its undeserved reputation as the quote-unquote party of peace was already in ruins after its direct participation in military assaults such as the July War against Lebanon in 2006 and January's Operation Cast Lead in Gaza that claimed lives of over 1,400 Palestinians, including 300 children and 116 women. The Israeli siege left the territory in ruins, with more than half of Gaza's 27 hospitals and 44 clinics damaged by Israeli bombs, according to the World Health Organization. Labour support has collapsed as a result, dropping from 19 to just 13 Knesset seats as the party fell into fourth place, eclipsed by Israel Beitenu. Even as the final preparations for Netanyahu's taking office are being made, the demands for Israel to face war crime charges relating to Operation Cast Lead, waged directly under Barak's leadership, are growing. Israeli newspapers have published the testimony of soldiers detailing atrocities in which they participated or that they witnessed in Gaza. United Nations human rights investigator for the Palestinian territories, Richard Falk, has issued a report declaring that Israel's siege of Gaza, quote, would seem to constitute a war crime of the gravest magnitude under international law. describing the Israeli campaign as, quote, massive assault on a densely populated, urbanized setting, end quote, and that subjected civilians to an inhuman form of warfare that kills, maims, and inflicts mental harm. Richard Falk listed war crimes such as the targeting of schools, mosques, and ambulances, and the use of white phosphorus shells in densely populated neighborhoods. The war on Gaza was not legally justified and would constitute a crime against peace, he argued, the principal charge against the Nazi leaders tried at Nuremberg. A report by human rights advocates who visited Gaza after the war accuses Israeli soldiers of shooting children, bulldozing a home with a woman and a child inside, and shelling a building they had ordered civilians to enter one day earlier. Physicians for Human Rights Israel has accused the army of repeatedly violating its own ethics code and possibly international law by impeding the evacuation of the sick and wounded and by endangering medical teams operating in Gaza. A month-long investigation by the Guardian newspaper has compiled detailed evidence of war crimes committed by Israel during the 23-day offensive, including the use of Palestinian children as human shields. Medics and ambulance men were targeted when they tried to tend to the wounded, and 16 were killed. The Guardian newspaper also cites evidence of civilians being hit by fire from unmanned drone aircraft, said to be so accurate that their operators can tell the color of the clothes worn by a target. Netanyahu's government will continue this campaign to destroy Gaza and to secure the permanent annexation of much of the West Bank to Israel. Labor's own Fig Leaf for participating in the coalition, Likud's agreement that it will work for peace with its neighbors and respect Israel's existing agreements, was exposed yesterday when it was revealed that Netanyahu has struck a secret deal with Lieberman to enable further settlement construction on the West Bank. Army Radio said that the plan to build on land known as E1 had been agreed upon, even though it did not appear in the official document relating to the coalition agreement. The aim is to build 3,000 new homes, starting from the West Bank settlement of Mahale Adumim, so as to create contiguity between the settlement and Jerusalem, preventing Palestinian construction between East Jerusalem and Ramallah. The isolation of East Jerusalem, the putative capital of a Palestinian state, would make any agreement on the question of permanent borders impossible. Regarding Iran, the Jerusalem Post revealed on March 16th that the coalition agreement between Likud and Israel Betanyu puts the fascistic Lieberman in charge of Israel's strategic dialogue with the United States on issues such as Iran. The Joint American-Israel Strategic Dialogue Committee is where key decisions are made regarding both countries' policies toward the emerging nuclear threat and on other key strategic issues and meetings twice a year. Kadima officials were surprised by the appointment and said it proved more than ever that Netanyahu's government would be dominated by the fascistic Lieberman. The government will also be charged with a historically unprecedented assault on the living standards of the Israeli working class. Fitch Ratings has said that Israel's economy will contract by 1.5% in 2009 and that its budget deficit will reach about 7%. Israel's ratio of debt to gross domestic product could rise to 90% by the end of 2010, from 77% now, and could potentially undermine Israel's credit worthiness. The Bank of Israel has reported that the main index of economic indicators dropped for a seventh consecutive month in February, indicating a continuation of the economy's drift toward a recession. This is translating into a steep growth in unemployment. In February, almost 20,000 workers were laid off, the highest monthly increase in Israel's history, leading to a number of bitter labor disputes. The situation now facing both the Israeli and Palestinian people poses grave dangers. The Zionist project of forging a nation state in which the Jews of the world would supposedly find liberty, equality, and social justice has failed. Established through the dispossession of the Palestinians, Israel has been maintained ever since through brutal wars and repression, while internally social divisions have become ever more acute. Today, the state was supposed to offer a home to the people who suffered the Holocaust is viewed as an international pariah and the perpetrator of obscene war crimes. It is ruled by a government that spans the official political spectrum, and that is in a state of undeclared war with the majority of its own citizens. The only way forward is through the development of a new socialist and internationalist political movement to unite Arab and Jewish workers in a struggle against all the region's ruling elites and their imperialist backers. That's an article from the latest edition of the World Socialist website at WSWS.org, published by the International Committee of the Fourth International. The article is entitled, "Labor Joins Netanyahu's Coalition as Evidence of War Crimes in Gaza Mount." You're listening to Seeing Red Radio. I'll take a break with David Rovics right here and be right back.
From Guatemala to Korea, to the tunnels beneath Hanoi, from Tulsa to El Chorizo, fat man to little boy. We fought them in Nicaragua and upon the Cuban shore. Killed Gaddafi's daughter, see what the fatwa's got in store. We're gonna bomb our way to freedom with the cruise missiles of justice and the spent shells of democracy. Oh, say, can you see? From Kabul to Khartoum, where Allah's martyrs bled, to the Iraqi desert, 200,000 people dead. We're gonna bomb our way to freedom with the cruise missiles of justice and the spent shells of democracy. Oh, say, can you see? From the school of the assassins to Argentina's dirty war, from Arizona to Nevada, we'll nuke our way to heaven's door. We're gonna bomb our way to freedom with the cruise missiles of justice and the spent shells of democracy. Oh, say, can you see? We're gonna bomb our way to freedom with the cruise missiles of justice and the spent shells of democracy. Oh, say, can you see?
The winter assault on the Gaza Strip was officially portrayed in Israel as an attempt to quell rocket fire by militants of Hamas. But some soldiers say that they were also lectured about a more ambitious aim, to banish non-Jews from the biblical land of Israel. A reserve sergeant said, recalling a training camp encounter, quote, "The rabbi comes to us and says the fight is between the children of light and the children of darkness. His message was clear. This is a war against an entire people, not against specific terrorists. The whole thing was turned into something very religious and messianic," end quote. As armies elsewhere use chaplains, the Israeli military inducts rabbis to serve religious soldiers. Their traditional tasks include ensuring that kitchens are kosher and religious services are available. But soldiers now going public with allegations of misconduct in Gaza portray the military rabbinate as a corps of self-appointed holy warriors whose sermons and writings demonized Palestinians. The army itself is a battleground of conflicting ideals in Israeli Jewish society, said Avi Sagi, a Bar-Ilan University philosophy professor, who in the 1990s was a co-author of the military's Code of Ethics, which obliges soldiers to avoid killing innocents. On one side, he said, are universal values that call for respecting all human life equally and are largely shared by Jews who seek accommodation with the Palestinians. On the other side are more nationalistic passages of the Torah, cited by religious thinkers who liken the Palestinians to Old Testament invaders and place a premium on Jewish life. In the Gaza conflict, The argument has focused on how to fight Islamic militants who for years have fired rockets indiscriminately at Israeli communities, causing scores of civilian casualties. Major Avital Leibovich, a military spokeswoman, denied that the military rabbinate takes sides. Army rabbis violated a directive to stay away from politics in Gaza, she said, but they were few in number and acted on their own. In testimony reported by Israeli news media and in interviews with the New York Times, Gaza veterans said rabbis advised army units to show the enemy no mercy and called for the resettlement of the Palestinian enclave by Jews. The rabbis were all over in every unit, said Yehuda Shaul, a retired army officer whose human rights group Breaking the Silence has taken testimony from dozens of Gaza veterans. It was quite well organized, he said. The army, which conscripts almost every Israeli Jew at 18, has been dominated for most of its history by secular officers. But over the last 15 years, as secular Israelis have soured on the occupation of Palestinian territory, religious nationalists have taken over senior positions in elite combat brigades. With them have come hundreds of volunteer rabbis who teach at pre-military academies for religious youths and serve side by side with the troops. The rabbis' role in Gaza came into focus last week, along with testimony from soldiers who said that loose rules of war led to unwarranted civilian deaths and property destruction. The testimony, reported by two Israeli newspapers, was the first such criticism to surface from within the army since the assault ended on the 18th of January, leaving an estimated 1,400 Palestinians and 13 Israelis dead. Most Palestinian casualties were listed as civilians. The Army Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Gabi Ashkenazi, said Monday that he did not believe soldiers shot Gaza civilians in cold blood. He added that isolated cases of misconduct, if proved, will be dealt with individually. Responding to newspaper photos, the Army also condemned soldiers who wore T-shirts depicting a pregnant woman in a rifle's crosshairs with the slogan, "One shot, two kills." During the Gaza offensive, critics contend rabbinical propaganda was part of a broader effort to legitimize Israel's decision to use overwhelming force. Before the assault, the Army's legal office issued an opinion saying that Israel was entitled to use artillery against civilian neighborhoods from which Hamas was launching rockets. And after the 22-day operation, a Tel Aviv University philosophy professor with close ties to the military, Asa Kasher, said the decision to shell Gaza City stemmed from an anti-terrorism doctrine he had helped draft a few years ago. It stated that in Gaza, as in other areas the army does not control, there is no justification for endangering soldiers' lives in order to avoid killing civilians in the proximity of targeted militants. That doctrine appears to be at odds with the military code, which obliges the army to avoid civilian casualties, and it was never formally adopted. However, it was echoed in religious terms in literature distributed in Gaza by military rabbis. One text read, quote, "Our ancestors did not always fight with a sword, and at times preferred to use a bow and arrow from a distance," one text read. "Actions must be taken from a distance in order to spare a soldier's lives." The reserve sergeant, an observant Jew who spoke to the New York Times on condition of anonymity, said that he and a fellow soldier in his 15-man unit were troubled by the Children of Darkness sermon, but that other troops seemed receptive. In one of several post-war testimonies given at a left-leaning military institute, a squad commander identified only as Ram complained that army rabbis tried to press what he called a religious mission on his men. The military rabbinate brought in a lot of booklets and articles, and their message was very clear. We are the Jewish people. We came to this land by a miracle. God brought us back to this land, and now we need to fight to expel the non-Jews who are interfering with our conquest of this holy land, Ram said. As a commander, he said, he tried to explain to his men that not everyone in Gaza is Hamas and wants to vanquish us, and that this war is not a war for the sanctification of the holy name, but rather one to stop the Qassams, a type of rocket fired from Gaza. Danny Zamir, director of the institute that elicited the testimonies and leaked them to Israeli papers, was quoted in a transcript as voicing dismay that Israeli nationalists, like their Hamas enemies, are using faith to justify violence. He said, quote, "If clerics are anointing us with oil and sticking holy books in our hands, and if the soldiers in these units aren't representative of the whole spectrum of the Jewish people, but rather of certain segments of the population, what can we expect?" End quote. Ofer Shelah, military correspondent at the newspaper Mariv, said the rising profile of religious nationalists in the Israeli army has helped them in two showdowns with the high command. After Israel withdrew its settlers and soldiers from Gaza in 2005, graduates of two pre-military academies associated with the settler movement said they would refuse to obey future orders to disband West Bank settlements. The army threatened to cancel its certification of the schools and then back down. During the Gaza assault, the chief military rabbi, Brigadier General Avakai Runsky, was called in to answer criticism that his department was distributing war propaganda. He denied knowledge of it, and a subordinate was given a slap on the wrist by the defense ministry, Shelah said. Rabbi David Hartman, a leading Jewish philosopher who has lectured thousands of officers at his Shalom Hartman Institute, said the religious nationalist belief in holy war is still a minority view in the army, but it has to be fought with a rational religious ideology that takes into account the living realities of two people. Otherwise, he added, you have these rabbis volunteering in the army, and it's not necessarily the people the army wants. There's a vacuum, and it gets filled by crackpots. That's an article that was just released in the Chicago Tribune, written by Richard Borodreau, called "Some Israeli Soldiers Say Military Rabbis Cast the Offensive Against Hamas Rockets as a Fight to Expel Non-Jews." You're listening to Seeing Red Radio, the radio show with a revolutionary socialist perspective. I'm your host, Anthony Udell. We'll continue coming up in just a little bit. International mining firms are cheating African countries out of their taxes due. And also, Robert Mueller is pushing our current FBI director to renew aspects of the Patriot Act. Gotta love it. It's a change that we can believe in. And before we'll finish up, we'll look at the latest spokesperson for the Anti-Employee Free Choice Act movement. Who else but Joe the Plumber? That's all coming up next. Seeing Red Radio. Please stay tuned.
Still labor to try to carry. coming that I know. A change is gonna come. Oh, yes it is. Just like I said, I went to my little bitty brother. And then I go to my little mother, my dear mother, old man. I said, mother, I'm down on my knees. But there was a time that I thought, Lord, this could last forever. Oh, my Lord. Somehow I thought I was still labor. Carry on. It's been a long time coming, but I know the change gotta go. Ooh. It's been so long, a little too long, but the change has gotta go.
Anti-poverty groups revealed on Wednesday that mining transnationals routinely deprive African countries of huge amounts of tax revenue that could be used to boost social development. Investigators found that mineral-rich countries are losing tens of millions of dollars because aggressive mining firms routinely force governments to grant tax subsidies and concessions by threatening to go elsewhere if they are not forthcoming. The revelations were made in a report entitled Breaking the Curse, the work of a coalition of non-governmental organizations, including Action Aid International and Christian Aid. It covers seven underdeveloped African countries: the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ghana, Malawi, Sierra Leone, South Africa, Tanzania, and Zambia. The report said Western firms are often granted low royalty rates because the contracts signed with government officials are often negotiated in secret, or government ministries have wide discretionary powers that MPs have no say over. And it alleges that bosses regularly resort to false accounting, artificially depressing profits, in countries where they operate in order to evade tax. It estimates that low royalty rates have or will cost South Africa, the continent's biggest gold producer, up to $359 million a year in revenue. Another top African gold producer, Ghana, is losing $68 million a year, and Tanzania, the continent's third largest producer, $30 million a year, which could have funded healthcare, education, and other social programs. Action Aid Pan-African policy manager Brian Kagaro said, quote, "One practical step to addressing poverty in Africa is to ensure that all multinational mining companies pay equitable amounts of tax. If they did, governments could fund social welfare programs with revenue generated from taxes rather than seeking to borrow money externally," end quote. Mr. Kagoro insisted that mining contracts and payments to governments need to be subjected to rigorous parliamentary scrutiny to improve accountability in this sector. He went on, quote, "And when we need to strengthen the capacity of national regulatory tax authorities as well as rationalize international accounting standards to ensure compliance," end quote. The report warns that seven countries have lost the chance to collect huge sums from a five-year boom in metal prices that ended last year. Report editor Kato Lambrecht said, quote, "The record amounts various minerals fetched until the bubble burst last year meant little or nothing to ordinary Africans," end quote. You just heard an article from the latest edition of the People's Weekly World at pww.org entitled "Mining Firms Cheat Africa Out of Millions." It's an article published from the Morning Star and can be found at morningstaronline.co.uk. You're listening to Seeing Red Radio. We'll be right back.
I got on the stage. It was an enormous auditorium. There are 2,700 young faces out there, none of them with any prospects anybody could detect. And off to the side of the stage was the suit and tie crowd of people from the school district and the principals, and the main speaker following me was from the Chamber of Commerce. Well, something inside of me snapped. And I got to the microphone, and I looked out over that multitude of faces, and I said something to the effect of, "You're about to be told one more time that you're America's most valuable natural resource. Have you seen what they do to valuable natural resources? Have you seen a strip mine? Have you seen a clear cut in the forest? Have you seen a polluted river? Don't ever let them call you a valuable natural resource. They're going to strip mine your soul. They're going to clear cut your best thoughts for the sake of profit unless you learn to resist. Because the profit system follows the path of least resistance. And following the path of least resistance is what makes the river crooked." Well, that was great gnashing of teeth and rending of garments. Mine. I was born to the door, screaming epithets over my shoulder, something to the effect of, "Make a break for it, kids! Flee to the wilderness!" The one within, if you can find it, well...
Utah Phillips with Natural Resources from the album that he did with Honey DeFranco called The Past Didn't Go Anywhere. You're listening to Seeing Red Radio. So while we contemplate the change that the president and the present presidential administration claimed throughout its campaign, now that we are post-campaign in the light of day, we examine how much change is actually there. And considering that earlier this month, the American Civil Liberties Union released a report taking stock of the USA Patriot Act, almost 8 years after its passage. The study, titled Reclaiming Patriotism, identifies key sections of the law that codify the most radical abuses of power under the Bush administration, interweaving stories of people who were unlawfully spied on, coerced, and intimidated through the Patriot Act's sweeping powers. Quote, "More than 7 years after its implementation, there is little evidence to demonstrate that the Patriot Act has made America more secure from terrorists," the report authors write. "But there are many unfortunate examples that the government abused these authorities in ways that both violated the rights of innocent people and squandered precious security resources," end quote. The American Civil Liberties Union report highlights three specific provisions of the Patriot Act that have led to unprecedented surveillance against Americans. Section 215, which drastically broadens the kinds of information the government can demand under FISA to any tangible thing while lowering the burden of proof to obtain an order. As the Washington Post explains, this measure, quote, "allows investigators probing terrorism to seek a suspect's records from third parties, such as financial services and travel and telephone companies, without notifying the suspect." The American Civil Liberties Union has criticized the provision, saying that it violates the First Amendment rights of U.S. citizens. Section 206, which grants the authority to use secret roving wiretaps. In the past, authorities had to seek court approval for each electronic device carried by a suspect, from a cell phone and a BlackBerry to a home computer. But under the provision, one warrant can cover all of these machines. Unlike roving wiretaps authorized for criminal investigations, Section 206 does not require the order to identify either the communications device to be tapped nor the individual against whom the surveillance is directed, which is what gives Section 206 the Kafka-esque moniker, the John Doe roving wiretap provision. And then there's Section 6001, or the lone wolf provision, which allows for secret FISA surveillance orders against people who have no connections to a terror group or a foreign nation. The government justified this provision by imagining a hypothetical lone wolf, an international terrorist operating independently of any terrorist organization, explains the American Civil Liberties Union, but there is little evidence to suggest that this imaginary construct had any basis in reality. All of these provisions are set to expire on December 31st of this year. However, yesterday, during an appearance before the Senate Judiciary Committee, FBI Director Robert S. Mueller made it clear that he considers these Patriot Act provisions valuable tools in intelligence gathering and will pressure Congress to keep them past their expiration date. Questioned by Senator Benjamin Cardin, a Democrat of Maryland, about the three major provisions that will sunset in 2009 and which have proven to be somewhat controversial, in the past, Mueller said, quote, "My hope, quite obviously, is that they will be less controversial as they come up this time because we have seen their use and have some track record with it," end quote. He described Provision 215 as exceptionally helpful, saying that the FBI had used it 223 times between 2004 and 2007. He said that the roving wiretaps provision had been used 147 times, and that also has eliminated a substantial amount of paperwork, and I would say confusion in terms of the ability for us to maintain electronic surveillance on an individual. As for the lone wolf provision, Mueller did not have figures to share. "While we have not, and there has not been a lone wolf, so to speak, indicted," he said, "that provision is tremendously helpful where we have difficulty showing a tie between a particular individual about whom we have information that he may be supporting terrorism or be a terrorist, but we have difficulty in identifying the foreign power for which he is an agent." Based on this theoretical, Mueller said the provision was beneficial and should be, quote, reenacted. Mueller said that he had not yet had a chance to discuss the sunset provisions in the Patriot Act with the Obama Department of Justice. "My hope is that the DOJ will support the reenactment of all three, but given Obama's embrace of and Democrats' utter capitulation to warrantless wiretapping last year, it may be an uphill fight to convince Congress to block the reauthorization of these Patriot Act provisions based on First Amendment concerns. But it's never too early to start trying. All lawmakers have, over time, built a massive surveillance mechanism, bit by bit. Now is the time to take it apart, examine each piece, and develop wiser policies." You're listening to Seeing Red Radio. We only have a few moments left before we hand over the mic to Leela, DJ Alduru, who is feeling considerably better than last week, where she graciously allowed me to fill in for her, which I enjoyed a great deal. We only have a few moments, but please stay tuned. We're going to come back with a little talk about EFCA and Joe the Plumber. That's on this week's edition of Seeing Red. Please stay tuned.
Come and listen to my story. Come and listen to my song. I will tell you of a hero who's now dead and gone. I will tell you of a young boy whose age was 19. He was the bravest Union man that I have ever seen. Harry Sims was a pal of mine. We labored side by side, expecting to be shot on sight or taken for a ride by them dirty coal-operated gun thugs that roam from town to town, a-shooting down the Union men where'er they may be found. Harry Sims was walking down the track one bright sunshiny day. He was a youth of courage, his step was light and gay. He did not know the gun thugs was hiding on the way to kill our brave young comrade this bright sunshiny day. Harry Sims was killed on Brush Creek in 1932. He organized the miners into the NMU. He gave his life in struggle, that was all that he could do. He died for the Union, also for me and you.
Pete Seeger with Harry Sims right here on Seeing Red Radio. Let's go from a great working class hero to working class traitor. Yeah, good old Joe the Plumber. He'll be speaking at rallies, a
against the Employee Free Choice Act, also known as Card Check by its opponents. It, of course, is an effort to give workers the legal ability to organize a union without all the crap that employers have legendarily mounted on union organizing drives. He'll speak in Pittsburgh, Harrisburg, Philadelphia at the end of this month, March 30th and 31st, according to a spokesman for the Anti-Employee Free Choice Act group called Americans for Prosperity. Man, these guys are perfect at Orwellian speak. The spokesperson, Mary Ellen Burke, claimed that the public loves Joe the Plumber. They see him as a role model. Asked whether Joe the Plumber had any particular knowledge or expertise about the Employee Free Choice Act that might explain the decision to enlist him, Burke said that he was being enlisted to provide a grassroots perspective and the working perspective on the measure. Pressed on whether Joe the Plumber has any particular claim to being a spokesperson on the issue, Burke replied that he represents the American worker. Right. Why don't you tell that to the real workers? Rick Turvin, the political legislative director for the United Association of Journeymen and apprentice for the plumbing and pipe fitting industry of the United States, tore into his high-profile plumber colleague as follow. Joe the Plumber is selling out real plumbers. Right now, labor law is stacked against real plumbers. Real plumbers want and need the Employee Free Choice Act as a way to empower themselves to join a union without fear of intimidation or losing their jobs. Joe the Plumber doesn't speak for real plumbers. Turvin claimed that the Plumbers Union, which says it has over 300,000 members, has done a survey of non-union plumbers, finding that 70% of them wanted to join a union if they could do so without fear of retribution. Though it can't be immediate, we couldn't immediately get the details of that particular survey. Actually, a real Plumbers for EFCA tour throughout Pennsylvania wouldn't actually be a terribly bad idea. Well, that's wraps up this edition of Seeing Red Radio. Thanks for tuning in. If you're looking for links to any of the articles or any of the music that you heard on tonight's edition, please check out the website at seeingredradio.org. You can check in, also comment on the show. It's a blog, so by all means, leave your comments. And if you've missed the show and you would like to check out the podcast, you can do so right there at the website as well, seeingredradio.org. Stay tuned. Coming up next on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ LP Northampton, the music of Flywheel with DJ Alduru. I'm going to leave you with Fela Kuti, with International Thief Thief, right here on Seeing Red Radio. Check you next week, comrades.